Welcome back to another broadcast of the Word for Life radio program. With me in the studio is the co-host of the broadcast, Dr. Greg Huffman, who is also one of the pastors at Brookside Baptist Church.
Pastor Sam, we were talking in our last session on meekness, and it is obviously one of the hardest things that God has to develop in our lives. I was looking at some notes recently that said that meekness is that disposition of spirit that accepts God's dealings with us as good, and therefore no disputing or resisting. Well, I tell you what, accepting God's dealings with us as good. So many times we want to tell God what we think needs to change.
I was kind of hoping you'd forget we were on that one, and we could just go right to hungry and thirsting after righteousness. But that wouldn't be very righteous, would it? You know, I think I told you in the last broadcast that that particular beatitude is the hardest one for me. Because meekness, and again, you've heard the old adage, meekness isn't weakness, but it isn't a dominating, domineering, roughshod, run-over-people personality either.
Right.
And I think people who are like me, whose personality tends to be more dominant, and, you know, I don't know where they came up with the type A, type B,
right,
but I happen to be probably in the type AAA plus category. It's very easy for us to kind of look at this, and I've done it in my own life, and just say, well, you know, that's how God made me, and people are just going to have to learn. And that really isn't what the Lord's talking about at all. Meekness is the filter through which whatever personality you have has to be played out. My personality is God-given. My personality is sin-tainted, and it has to be played out through the grid of meekness. It doesn't matter if you're type A, type B, type C, or whatever. You still have to be meek. And meekness comes back then to literally the whole idea of cultivating the right personal disposition. And what you read a moment ago is the key to that disposition, accepting what God has given.
Because as we recognize God as a sovereign God, we have to understand that God has allowed somebody to say something or do something or a circumstance to take place. Then he's looking at me and my response, and he's saying, okay, are you going to respond with a meek and quiet spirit? It was amazing to me that back in the Old Testament, the Bible described Moses as the meekest man on the face of the earth. Moses. And when the controversy arose with his sister and his brother concerning the leadership of the nation of Israel, he said nothing because of his own meekness. But then God stepped in and struck Miriam with leprosy and began to talk to Aaron as well. And the lesson there, of course, for me is, you know, when I step in, many times God steps back. But if I don't step in and I respond with a meek spirit, God will step in.
Yeah. And boy, we have a tendency to jump in.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
You know, it's interesting you brought up Moses. Here's a man whose life has been defined primarily by two incidents. I mean, when you think of Moses and you hear people write about Moses, typically what tends to happen is he gets targeted and he gets kind of identified as the guy who was angry. Moses had a temper problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out of two incidents. One, it came out of an incident when he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God, and he rose up in indignation at what the Egyptian overseer was doing to one of the Israelites, and he slew him in anger.
Right.
And the next is 80 years later in the wilderness. You know, he goes out for 40 years, and then 40 years into it, or thereabouts, so 80 years afterwards, he strikes a rock in anger to the people. And you step back and you think, now the whole of Moses' life, for most people, has been kind of
two incidents,
categorized by those two incidences. But here's how God categorizes him. He's the meekest man of his generation.
Exactly. Right.
And that really ought to change the way we see Moses.
Mm-hmm.
And when you stop and think about who he was leading and what those people were consistently doing,
we'd have been worse than he was.
Well, God actually says to Moses, now move out of the way, step out of the way, because I am going to burn those people up. I mean, God was far more angry visibly and outbursts of anger at those people than Moses ever was.
And then he steps in and pleads for their
right.
lives. Now, what is so funny is when God said, okay, Moses, I'll make a great nation out of you. Now, had that been us, we'd have said, hot dog.
We'd have taken him
up
on it.
Let's do it, God, you and me all the way. You know, and instead, Moses said, no. What will people say? You can't do that.
Right.
You know, and it's just amazing how meek Moses was in his daily living, despite all of the complaining and the griping that he got coming his way.
And I think this is what Jesus is going after. He's looking at his disciples and he's saying, now look, as citizens of this kingdom, you need to look like the king.
Right.
So that means you've got to have a proper mindset toward yourself. You've got to look at the world the way I look at it. You've got to mourn over sin. You've got to be meek. You've got to have the right disposition in your life. I mean, think about Peter. Peter is not exactly who I would think of if I were trying to categorize a meek guy. We'll talk more about meekness when we get into that beatitude.
Right.
But fourthly, he's a guy or a person who cultivates the right inner desires and drives. He hungers and thirsts after righteousness. I'm never going to get the kind of righteousness that Jesus is talking about if I go the Pharisees route. The only way I'm going to get it is if I cultivate an inner desire for it so that I literally hunger and thirst after it. These are people who are full of mercy. Blessed are the merciful. These are people who are undivided in their loyalty to God. Blessed are the pure of heart. They are undivided in their loyalty to God, and they aggressively seek the biblical welfare of other people. Blessed are the peacemakers. You know, we typically think of a peacemaker as somebody who's just calming everybody down and who, but a person who's a biblical peacemaker is aggressively going after the biblical well-being.
Because he's going after the people who are at war, and he's trying to help them to understand how the other person may be thinking or intending or that kind of a thing. And, you know, to be honest with you, we ourselves have to be peacemakers even in our prayer life.
Right.
You know, when it comes to the Lord's Prayer. And I saw this a couple of years ago that it just blew me out of the water, that every pronoun in the Lord's Prayer is plural. Our Father, us, and we, and because it's so easy for me to pray a prayer that's good for me. And it may not be good for the rest of the body of Christ,
right,
but it's good for me.
You know? Well, and you know, I was reading Philip Ryken, who has a tremendous little book on the Lord's Prayer. And he points that out, and he talks about this prayer being a family prayer.
Exactly. Wow.
Our elder brother talks to us about how we're supposed to talk to the Father about the family.
And it's that's a peacemaker, isn't it?
That's exactly what a peacemaker is.
Yeah.
The other way to see a peacemaker is the idea of sometimes to have peace, you got to go to war. And to aggressively seek the biblical well-being of another person means I've got to go to war against the things that are standing in the way of that. You know, as a marriage counselor, I'm sure you've run into places where you've looked at a couple that's about to break up, and you've literally had to go to some of those couples and say, you're going to have to go to war over this to get this out of your life if you have any hope of saving your marriage.
And the same thing is true when it comes to parenting.
Yeah.
Parents have to sometimes go to war with their kids, and they don't want to. They want to be their kids' friends as opposed to their kids' parents. And it never works.
Right.
You know, they have to be willing to go to war to eventually bring about peace. And it's interesting, the proverb says that when you do that, then there will be rest in the home.
Exactly. And I know the imagery of war can sometimes be misconstrued by people to say, well, that means I can go and have a good fight.
No.
And that's why I like the way that the Lord is expressing this. It is an aggressive seeking of the well-being of another person biblically.
Right.
And that brings us to the eighth thing, and that is when a person actually lives this way in a world that is totally contrary to this, he's going to experience persecution. And Jesus actually says that one of the marks of divine approval, if you want to know if God approves you, then here's what you ought to be experiencing from the people who are going against God. You're going to get persecuted. And you go through the scriptures, Moses, Abraham, Daniel, all of these men,
Joseph,
they experienced persecution. And the New Testament talks about the fact that we ought to plan on persecution coming. So the Lord begins the sermon by talking to us about the character of the disciples that ought to be cultivated. Then he talks a little bit in the next part of the sermon in Matthew 5:13 through 16 about the calling of a disciple. If you're this kind of a person, if you're manifesting the Beatitudes, what kind of a person are you supposed to be? And you're supposed to be a person that has spiritual impact. And remember the two illustrations he uses?
Salt and light.
Salt and light.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't typically think about salt as having a lot of impact. And in fact, today salt has, you know, if you talk to people about salt, it's like, oh, it's a negative, it hurts your heart. But in Jesus' day, salt was a very valuable commodity.
It was like gold.
It was like gold. In fact, you got paid. We get our word salary from the word salt.
Yeah, right.
And light was a very valuable commodity. I mean, we've got electric lights and, you know, all kinds of lights now, but back in Jesus' day, you didn't have You had natural light, and then you had firelight.
Right.
And to take light from one place to another was a big deal. And Jesus is saying, that's your calling. You're to be salt and light, the two most important, most valued commodities in a world. That's what you're to be for the gospel's sake. And then he says, now, the way that you're going to actually be salt and light is through your conduct. He starts with their character in the first part of the sermon. He goes to their calling, salt and light, and he says, now the character's got to come out in your conduct. And he starts talking to them in verses 21 through 26 about what their conduct ought to be like. You can't retain an angry heart. You can't be angry. You can't retain a lustful heart. You can't lust in your heart. You can't retain a disloyal heart. You can't break the covenant that you made with the wife of your youth.
Right?
You can't cultivate or tolerate a false heart. No false oaths. No vengeance taking. I mean, he literally starts talking to them about the areas of life that we most are prone to be unrighteous in.
And that's probably where a lot of the people who were sitting around the disciples began to stir. Because they probably thought, you know, this guy was pretty good, but he's meddling now.
Until he started messing with us.
Right.
Well, then the Lord goes on in chapter 6 to talk about the religious conscience of a disciple and talking particularly about the praying and the Lord's Prayer. In the last part of chapter 6, he talks to them about the commitments of a disciple in life. What are we supposed to do with our life? Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness.
Right.
And then he talks in chapter 7 about the relational concerns. How am I supposed to treat my brother? How am I supposed to treat all men? And then what about the carefulness about spiritual things that a righteous disciple will have to obey the truth and guard the truth and display the truth in his life? So the sermon really breaks up nicely, and it ends with a huge application. Jesus says, now every man who's hearing the sermon fits in one or two categories.
So now he's giving the invitation.
He's giving the invitation.
Okay.
And at the end, he says, you're either like the man who hears my words and does them, or you're like the man who doesn't. And if you do my words, you're like the guy who builds his house on a rock. And if you don't, you're like the guy who builds his house on the sand. And when the storm of life comes, one stands and the other falls.
And that's exactly where so many lives are today. And in my counseling, so many folks want the house that'll stand, but they aren't willing to set it on the rock.
And that means I've got to listen to the words
and
do them.
Exactly.
And Pastor Greg, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up the first part of our series. I'm looking forward as we come back again and start looking in at the different parts of the sermon and making the application to our life. But until then, may the Lord bless you.